Come then to Roman numeral 2 under the post-Constantine expansion of the church to an evaluation of the Constantinian change. A is the nature of the change, and 1 is the fact that Constantine's religious policy toward other religions has been evaluated in vastly different ways. As a contrast between Verdun and the church historian Laterette. Verdun says Constantine was just as intolerant after his conversion as he had been before. Now gatherings in the signature of the old religion were forbidden, often in the very words of the earlier proscriptions against Christian gatherings. The mere placing of a votive offering at an ancient shrine was forbidden by law. Unbaptized persons were now required by imperial law to attend indoctrination classes with a view to baptism. Those who refused to go to the font after such indoctrination were subject to severe penalty. Any person who after such forced baptism relapsed into the old ways was subject to exterminatio, the Latin, which can mean either death or exile. Laterette, on the other hand, says, the policy of Constantine was one of toleration. See, there's a slight contrast here. You see that? He did not make Christianity the sole religion of the state. That was to follow under later emperors. He continued to support both paganism and Christianity. In 314, when the cross first appeared on his coins, it was accompanied by the figures of Sol Invictus and Mars Conservator. To the end of his days, he bore the title of Pontifex Maximus, as chief priest of the pagan state cult. Pontifex Maximus is derived from the fact that the Roman emperor was the original head of the pagan state cult, and only by derivation comes to be applied to popes. Okay? The subservient Roman Senate followed the long-established custom and classed him among the gods. He did not persecute the old faiths. Schaff's verdict is best. He says, he continued in later years true upon the whole to the toleration principles of the Edict of 313. There were inconsistencies. Christian heretics or schismatics fared worse than pagans, i.e. Donatists did suffer persecution. Arians and later Athanasians were exiled for resisting Constantine's drive for a unified church. Two, in his later years, he issued a general prohibition of idolatrous sacrifice. This was not widely enforced. Constantine did come out more and more firmly for Christianity as later years. It was Constantine's sons and successors, however, that became more and more intolerant of paganism. I think what Verdun is doing is telescoping everything that happened as a result of the Constantinian change in succeeding centuries, telescoping it all back into Constantine. And that's a natural thing to do, you might say, because, I mean, it was that change that led to all the rest and the assumptions of that change. But Verdun has really vastly overstated the matter because of that generalization, taking what his sons and successors did and telescoping it all back into Constantine himself. And that's not good historical practice. I mean, it does make a point, doesn't it? Because the Constantinian change was, in principle, a change to a kind of Christian sacralism, which had to mean persecution at some level of everybody but the Orthodox state Christian religion. Nonetheless, all that didn't happen immediately. All that took centuries to happen. And you can't blame Constantine for it all. Two. While Constantine officially pursued a policy of toleration, yet from the beginning of his embrace of Christianity, and this is what I was just saying, there was an unavoidable tendency toward a practical union of church and state. And this was inevitable. Given the sacral view of the state, which dominated both his thinking and that of his citizens, given the immense authority he wielded by his example, and given the innate exclusiveness of Christianity, an intolerant church state was unavoidable and eventual issue of his conversion, though its issue was not intolerance during the reign of Constantine himself, at least not towards everybody. This tendency toward a practical union of church and state is reflected in the attitude entertained by Constantine that as a Christian emperor, he was a divinely appointed bishop, a bishop, so to speak, over the external affairs of the church. He certainly acted as a universal bishop when he summoned the first ecumenical council in 324 or 325. This mentality was, of course, all the more easy for him to adopt since he was and remained Pontifex Maximus, of the former pagan state religion. Well, you think of it from Constantine's perspective. I mean, he's emperor. Emperors are the head of the state of religions. That's what sacralism dictates. That's the way things had been since the beginning of the world. And so, of course, if he becomes a Christian, he's the universal bishop of the Christian religion. He's not going to meddle in the doctrinal affairs he doesn't know much about, but the external affairs, that's his business. He's emperor. And his mindset is sacral. So, of course, this is the way it is. So before we judge him too harshly, we have to understand that you've got the momentum of 3,000 years of sacralism behind this and the assumptions that he had about himself as emperor and that all Romans had about himself as emperor going on. But having talked about the negative aspects of the change, the positive aspects of the change must be considered. Now, having said all of this, if there had been an election for emperor in 318 and you'd been voting, you'd have voted for Constantine every time. You would have. Because a lot of good stuff happened, okay? Constantine was like somebody said about democracy. Democracy is not a very good form of government. It's just so much better than all the rest. So of Constantine, he wasn't a very good emperor. He was just so much better than all the rest. Anyway, the positive aspects of the change. Too often the positive results of Constantine's conversion are missed because the long-range debasing of Christianity by its union with the state fills our view, the long-range Christian sacralism. You know, I was thinking about this earlier. Christianity is an exclusive religion. That means that when you bring sacralism and combine it with an exclusive religion like Christianity, the result can only be toxic, right? It's the worst of all religions to have sacralistic assumptions about. I mean, other religions were syncretistic. They would combine with others. Christianity and Judaism would not. So, in one sense, the most intolerant, persecuting of all sacral religions would be a sacralistic Christianity, right? Sadly to say. But there were good things as well, which must not be ignored. There was a cessation of persecution. You would have liked that. Grandma and grandpa, mom and dad aren't languishing in prison anymore. There was the legalization of Christianity. Christianity had been legalized before, as we saw in 260, but this decree would not lapse. In a sense, of course, Christianity was over-legalized. The laws went too far in favor in Christianity. Yet on the whole, this change was certainly positive for Christians. Sunday was made a legal holiday, and this gives the element of truth, or the plausibility of truth to all those Seventh-day advertisements, Seventh-day Adventist advertisements about the Sunday being an invention of Constantine and some of the other dumb things they say. I'm sorry, but they're dumb. We're going to see that the Lord's Day was practiced by Christians for centuries before Constantine made it a legal holiday. In the next section, part three of the course. Nonetheless, Sunday was made a legal holiday. Tax exemptions were granted to clergy of churches. So we have Constantinian precedent for our tax exemptions, Eric. So just remember that. It goes way back to Constantine. We can plead that in court. The civil powers already exercised by the bishops were legalized. The church's right to receive legacies was established. In other words, people could start leaving their estates and money to the church, which, well, was probably a good thing within measure until the church came to own half the property in the Roman Empire. Then it wasn't such a good thing. But and you might think, what about the civil powers already exercised by the bishops? I remember reading about Augustine. You know what Augustine spent most of his day doing, several days a week? Hearing cases from the bishop's seat. And not cases about excommunication or religious matters, civil cases. Because it became the custom of Christians. All right, now this, you think about this, and maybe it kind of makes sense, but became the custom of Christians. I mean, you had a choice. You could take your case, if you're Christians, to the corrupt Roman government, or you could take, and then also be condemned by the New Testament for taking your case against a fellow Christian to civil law, and to a corrupt civil law to boot, or you could take your case between two Christians to the bishop, and maybe find something like justice and scriptural equity from the bishop. And so the bishops became justices of the peace in a lot of highly Christian communities. And though it seems kind of strange, and it was, and Augustine finally had to hire his, or ordain his successor and let him hear all those cases so he'd get a little time to write books. Nonetheless, you can see why it might happen, right? But the bishops were actually empowered now by law to exercise civil powers. Interesting. There was the restoration of church property, so all the buildings and money that had been confiscated were returned. I mean, you can't complain about that, right? Fourth, there was the humanization of civil government. The civil powers given bishops had a beneficial effect. Further, other laws were gradually improved. Schaff remarks, here again the reign of Constantine is a turning point. Though an Oriental despot, but perfectly possessed of the earnestness of Christian morality, he nevertheless enacted many laws which distinctly breathed the spirit of Christian justice and humanity. The abolition of the punishment of crucifixion, the prohibition of gladiatorial games and cruel rites, the discouragement of infanticide, and the encouragement of the emancipation of slaves. Eusebius says he improved most of the old laws or replaced them by new ones. From here forward, we feel beneath the toga of the Roman lawgiver the warmth of a Christian heart. Now, all this didn't happen at once, of course. The gladiatorial games, I think, weren't abolished for almost a century after the reign of Constantine. But again, the Constantine's accession was the turning point. The status of women in the family were gradually improved under Constantine's successors. The poor and unfortunate in general, above all the widows and orphans, prisoners and sick, who were so terribly neglected in heathen times, now drew the attention of the imperial legislators. Constantine in 315 prohibited the branding of criminals on the forehead, that the human countenance, as he said, formed after the image of heavenly beauty, should not be defaced. He provided against the inhuman maltreatment of prisoners before their trial. To deprive poor parents of all pretext for selling or exposing their children, he had them furnished with food and clothing, partly at his own expense and partly at that of the state. He likewise endeavored, particularly by a law of the year 331, to protect the poor against the venality and extortion of judges, advocates, and tax collectors who drained the people by their exactions. In the year 334, he ordered that widows, orphans, the sick, and the poor should not be compelled to appear before a tribunal outside their own province. Valentinian in 365 exempted widows and orphans from the ignoble poll tax. Around 404, the gladiatorial games were finally abolished. Took a while, but they finally got rid of them. See, the negative aspects. The negative results of the union of church and state have been epitomized in different ways. Verdine speaks of Constantine's war standard, the labarum, we looked at it, which is a cross made out of a spear, says that the standard was the symbol of the change. The cross, he says, had a blade welded to it. Well, there's too much truth in that. It's really picturesque, and there's too much truth to it. Another has said that the church is now free to go into the world, and the world is free to go into the church. Schaff speaks of the secularization of the church. The negative aspects of the Constantinian change can be enumerated as follows. One, there was the undesirable popularity of Christianity because of imperial patronage. Two, there was the undesirable support of Christianity by imperial taxes. So now the church is going to be supported by taxes. Not just tax exempt, but supported by taxes. Constantine built churches, diverted tax funds to clergy. This, by the way, is what sparked the Donatist controversy, because then the question became, which church in North Africa gets the bounty? And then the government had to decide whether the Donatists or the Catholics were the Christian church in North Africa. And then when they decided the Catholics were, of course, the Donatists were being discriminated against because the Catholics were getting all the goodies and the Donatists were not. Both because of this support and the habit of superstitious professing Christians leaving immense tracts of land to the church became wealthy and corrupt. The distinguished heathen prefect, Praetextatus, I told you there was a guy by that name, Praetextatus, said to Pope Damasus, and this is, you see where you get, I think this is where we get pretext from, said to Pope Damasus that for the price of the bishopric of Rome, he himself might become a Christian at once. Praetextatus. Church soon owned the tenth part of all the landed property, says Schaff. Wealthy subjects, some from pure piety, others from motives of interest, conveyed their property to the church, often to the prejudice of the just claims of their kindred. Bishops and monks not rarely used unworthy influences with widows and dying persons, though Augustine positively rejected every legacy, which deprived a son of his rights. Valentinian I found it necessary to oppose the legacy hunting of the clergy. What was that? Well, you know, go to the old people who are about to die and suggest that things might go better for them after they die if they gave all their money to the church, to your particular monastery. So he found it necessary to oppose the legacy hunting of the clergy, particularly in Rome, with the law of the year 370, and Jerome acknowledges there was good reason for it. The wealth of the church was converted mostly into real estate, or at least secured by it, and the church soon came to own the tenth part of all the landed property. This land, to be sure, had long been worthless or neglected, but under favorable conditions rose in value with uncommon rapidity. At the time of Chrysostom, towards the close of the 4th century, the Church of Antioch was strong enough to maintain entirely or in part 3,000 widows and consecrated virgins, besides many poor, sick, and strangers. The metropolitan churches of Rome and Alexandria were the most wealthy. The various churches of Rome in the 6th century, besides enormous treasures and money and gold and silver vases, owned many houses and lands, not only in Italy and Sicily, but even in Syria, Asia Minor, and Egypt. And when John, who bears the honorable distinction of the almsgiver for his unlimited liberality to the poor, became Patriarch of Alexandria, 606, he found in the church treasury 8,000 pounds of gold, and himself received 10,000, though retained hardly an ordinary blanket for himself, and is said on one occasion to have fed 7,500 poor at once. So by many bishops, this wealth was put to good use, but of course not by all. In many, it caused corruption. A third thing that was negative was the secular intervention in Christian doctrinal formulation. Well, in the first centuries that followed, when the church retained a fair degree of integrity, this contributed to the formulation of Orthodox Christian doctrine for the following generations. On the other hand, it made the character of orthodoxy subject to political caprice. So the first results of it in the Council of Nicaea were at least orthodox. But in the immediately following years, when the emperor was no longer Constantine but Constantius, and he was an Arian, then orthodoxy became Arian. The world groaned to find itself Arian, says Jerome, of the accession partly of Constantius. Then there was the secular punishment of Christian heretics. Not only Arians and Donatists were persecuted, but then Athanasius himself, when the emperors became sympathetic to Arianism, was deposed and exiled in 337. That happened when he wouldn't accept Arius back into the church. This is well put by Verdine. One of the most far-reaching enactments intended to support the new sacralism was the legal identification of heresy with sedition or crime against the state. Deviation on the plane of the sacerdotium became deviation on the plane of the regnum. We have seen how this was operative at Jesus' trial, and we have argued that failure to distinguish between these two is the inevitable outcome of a flat theology. What does Verdine mean by a flat theology? Well, it's the idea that there's no difference between the Old Testament, where you have the union of church and state, and the New Testament. It's flat. Rather than seeing a progression in which the New Testament is on a higher spiritual plane than the Old Testament, you have a flat theology. That's what Verdine is talking about. Even though the confusion of heresy with sedition follows naturally from sacral presuppositions, the fashioners of Christian sacralism saw to it that the identification of the two kinds of infraction was hardened into imperial law. This identification stood firm for the whole span of time known as the Middle Ages and became a leading issue in the Reformation. We read in the codes of Justinian that, quote, heresy is to be construed to be an offense against the state. Everything that is of evil and practiced on the level of religion is to be counted as crime. So heresy is crime. Sin is crime. With the coming of Christian sacralism, the old dream of going forward by going backward was realized. Verdine has a way with words, doesn't he? In Constantine's change, the spirits of the Maccabees and the ghosts of the Zealots rode again. The kingdom of Christ, which the Savior in his hour of trial had declared to be not of this world, was now as much a kingdom of the world as any that had ever existed. The sword that Jesus had told Peter to put away was again drawn from its sheath by men who wanted to be known as the vicars of Peter. And these self-styled vicars began at once to instruct the regnum to hack and hew with it in the very domain from which Jesus had banished it. Wow, good stuff. Constantine himself, while not abandoning his sacralistic principles, was not himself the tyrannical persecutor that Verdine paints him to be. Walker, speaking of this persecution of the Donatists in North Africa, he says, Constantine was dissatisfied with the results, and in 321 he abandoned the use of force. Okay, that brings us to Roman numeral 3, the consequent expansion of the church. And there was, of course, a vast expansion of the church after Constantine became a Christian. Its immensity, the church's membership quadrupled in size in the 100 years after the conversion of Constantine. According to one authority, Lateret says that by 500, the church constituted the overwhelming majority of the empire. B, a superficiality. Bruce says, Christianity thus became fashionable, which was not really a good thing. Varnes comments, the descriptions by Jerome, middle of century 4, of what he himself experienced in Rome fill us with horror. And Dr. Ebrard summarizes these accounts as follows. So this is Jerome, who the author of the Latin Vulgate, and the great church father. Ebrard is summarizing what he tells us about Rome in the middle of the 4th century, 350 or so. Very many applied for the presbyterate and diaconate with the intention of having readier access to the women, whom as church officers they could visit at home. The whole concern of these clerics was directed to adornments and perfumes. They curled their locks with the hot iron, wore flashing rings, changed the horses of their chariots every hour. To carry tales and to slander the absent was their chief activity in their pastoral visitations. The prominent Christian women wore gold-brocaded clothing, kept a retinue of eunuchs, surrounded themselves with flatterers and parasites, among whom the clerics were chief. The daughters maintained the pretense of virginity by the abortion of fruit conceived out of wedlock. Virginity in unmarried women was a rarity and therefore an occasion of spiritual pride. Young girls were accustomed to get tipsy with wine. Ascetics abstained from marriage, and so as to make abstention more difficult and more brilliant, they kept sorores, or sisters, in their houses so as to live together with them in pure spiritual love. What a misguided conception of holiness, huh? I'm going to show how holy I am by how much temptation I can resist. That's a really bad idea. What was begun in the spirit, haughty fanaticism, ended almost without exception in the flesh and in the filth. Christendom was not everywhere so wholly depraved as in Rome, but neither was the pagan population. Yet the relationship between both was everywhere so pretty nearly alike that Christendom absorbed more heathenism from the heathen than did the heathen Christianity from the Christians. The application is plain, of course. Growth is not always the sign of God's blessing. It may simply be the sign of human compromise. too often the case. C, it's resistance. New religions emerged as opponents of Christianity about this time, especially Neoplatonism and Manichaeism. These were eventually inundated in the Christian rise. Pockets of resistance to Christianity, however, remain. Palestine, surprisingly, and many of the more remote rural areas, as I told you before, the term paganismus rose during these years. It meant peasant religion. Then finally, Roman numeral 4, the expansion of the church outside the Roman Empire. Now, I apologize because I now realize that I have overlooked Persia, and you're going to read in Needham of the fact that there was a large Christian church in Persia to the east of the Roman Empire, the Regnum Parthicum, see it there? The Parthians are the Persians, by the way, and the Persian Empire extended, you know, after you got away from Palestine and Syria, extended out that way, and there were constant wars between Rome and Persia, but there was also a large church in Persia, although it became Nestorian, and Needham will tell you about that, and that was a Christological heresy, but nonetheless, large churches in Regnum Parthicum. But besides that, Armenia needs to be noted. The mass conversion of Armenia occurred in the late 3rd century. The instrument of this was a man called Gregory the Illuminator. At first he encountered persecution, but then he won the king to the faith, and the rest was easy. Too easy, because in making the transition more palatable for the populace, he compromised Christian standards. Gregory was consecrated the first bishop of Armenia, and this universal bishopric remained hereditary. The sons of the bishop inherited the episcopacy from him. Well, at least they didn't believe in celibacy, right? What can I say? Even before the Constantinian change, here is an instance of zealous Christian missionary willingly accepting the welding together of church and state for the supposed furtherance of Christianity, but then compromising true Christianity in so doing. And again, what's the point? The point is everybody thought in these sacral terms. And so it wasn't like, let's deliberately commit this terrible crime of sacralism. No, it was just, that's the way history was. That's what 3,000 years of sacralism gave you. So we need to have a little bit of moderation before we condemn these people that are simply acting out of the universal spirit of the age. The Goths. The barbarian Goths and many of the barbarians who invaded the empire were, quote, Christians. Did you know that? They had been evangelized by one Ulfilas, who had been taken captive by the Goths in a raid on Asia Minor in 267. His great work was the translation of the Bible into Gothic. Ulfilas did not include the books of Samuel and Kings in his translation. He thought the Goths were warlike enough without those. That's what they say. Though possibly a disciple of an Orthodox bishop, Ulfilas came to hold Arian views. When the Goths sacked Rome, the carnage was reduced in some degree by their Christianity. They at least didn't burn the churches. Generally, they treated the Catholic bishops and churches with respect. They eventually were absorbed in the empire's Catholicism by diligent missionary work among them by the Orthodox early Catholics. And then Ireland. Ireland was never part of the Roman Empire, you'll notice. Neither was Scotland, so Ireland and Scotland were outside the empire. It was also evangelized by one taken captive and sold as a slave among the Irish, a man by the name of Patrick. He was born in 389 after escaping and pursuing the Christian ministry in Gaul. So he escaped, came all the way down to France there, spent time in France. He returned as a missionary to Ireland. At his death, March 17, 461, at least that's one dating of it. I saw that Needham says it could have been 460 or 490, but anyway. Ireland was basically Christian. When the barbarian invasions cut Britain off from the Roman Empire, Ireland became a separate center from which Christianity radiated out over Britain and Northern Europe. The unique aspect of Irish Christianity was that its centers were the monastery and the abbot, not the church and the bishop. Christianity also touched many other lands by 500. Persia, where there are many Christians of national origin. China, some evidence for Nestorian churches as far as China. India, very likely Christianity was early planted there, even perhaps by the Apostle Thomas, but most probably during the 3rd century. Well, that completes our lectures for this evening. Questions? Interrogation? Thoughts? Considerations? Okay. You're dismissed. I'll see you next week when we begin part 3 of the course, The Apostolic Fathers.